Hey there! If you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. I'm Tara, your host. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Hey, welcome everyone, and thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to Crime Off the Grid. We've got Ranger Dan back with us today to discuss the story. And Ranger Dan was just here a couple of episodes ago talking about a poaching case that he investigated in Yellowstone. It's called Yellowstone Headhunter. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, make sure you go back and check it out. So just to recap Ranger Dan's credentials, he has over 25 years as law enforcement ranger with the National Park Service, and he worked in Yellowstone National Park, Denali National Park, Gulf Islands National Seashore, came back to Yellowstone, went to Mesa Verde National Park, Grand Canyon National Park, and back to Yellowstone, which is the park he retired from, and most of his time in Yellowstone was spent doing backcountry patrols and supervision. So did I get that right? Anything again this time?
That sounds good. That's pretty much the basic outline.
Very good. Well, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here. I was just thinking of this subject that we're going to be talking about and some background of mine that might relate to it that maybe I'll set up a little bit with.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So it has kind of a lot to do with how I got into the Park Service. And just in brief, when I was growing up, I was just kind of a young outdoorsman and learned about hunting and fishing and all that from my dad and my grandpa and, you know, other folks. And I was just thinking about when I went to the hunter safety course that you had to go to so that you could get your hunting license, kind of like a driver's license where you can hunt with an adult when you're 12 years old.
Right.
That I was in.
Yeah.
If you took this class. And the class was taught by two conservation officers, as they're called, where I grew up. So they're game wardens.
Yeah.
And I decided during the course of that class that I was going to be a conservation officer.
Wow.
I wanted to be those two guys. Like, they talked about what they did with their job and how they would interact with us when we were hunters and things. And it was just clear as day to me, like, that's me. That's going to be me when I grow up.
Wow.
And so I always told everyone that's what I was going to
And look at you.
Yeah. And then
And look at you now.
So, yeah, and that, you know, that eventually, you know, translated on the park ranger thing. When I saw what that park rangers could basically be a conservation officer, you know, that do the same things that they do. And so all of my the other thing that I had to be was a commando. So I did have to spend some time in the military.
Right.
And then I went to college.
Thank you for that.
Oh, certainly. Thank you. So when I went to college, so I took classes in law enforcement, criminal justice, and a lot of natural resource related classes, all with the goal of getting into being a conservation officer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I learned about the Park Service while I was in college. One of my professors had a connection with Yellowstone to do internships.
Oh.
And so I was asked if I wanted to take this internship for the summer out in Yellowstone. And I said, yes. And the professor said, do you want to think about it overnight or anything? And I said, no. So I got sent to this little ranger station in the southwest corner of Yellowstone. And I was just all in when I, you know, got to do some of the job.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was just going to be my career. And so I went on to spend I worked 9 years at that ranger station, which is a pretty big chunk of your career.
Yeah. No, it is.
And that's where I got to meet a lot of people on both sides of the law enforcement and poacher equation. What I was thinking about was I actually worked my first hunting season. I got to go out on patrol with two different Idaho game wardens.
Oh.
And when I went with them, a lot of what the reason why they would come and pick up a park ranger and to go out on patrol with them is it gave us a chance to get experience with hunting contacts working in a park where you weren't allowed to hunt.
Right. Yeah.
that we could actually go out and talk to people who were hunting legally and see how they investigated and kind of, you know, how a game warden would extract information from people, whether they were suspicious or whether they were just good outdoorsmen, you know, sportsmen who wanted to give information on what they were seeing out there.
Right.
And, you know, they left their business card at every camp to let people know that, that they were there. But what they would say about why they like bringing us along, how they benefited, is it was another person with a badge and a gun on who was on their side.
Right.
And a lot of their reasoning, they worked alone almost all the time otherwise.
Yeah, right.
A lot of their reasoning that they wanted to have that second backup officer was because of this incident that we're about to talk about.
Yeah.
So it was very fresh in there. It only happened, it was still 10 or 15 years, you know, before that, but it was very fresh in the mind of Idaho game wardens.
Well, and so, this is why I'm really happy that you agreed to talk about this case with me. And this story is one that I became aware of from the beginning of my law enforcement career with the National Park Service. And so obviously you did too, especially spending time with the Idaho game wardens, because we're talking about Claude Dallas. And this is a case that framed and changed the way we trained as law enforcement officers in remote and wilderness areas. And I think it's great that you got that experience. And I'm just wondering, since we're going to talk about this case, but your time with the Idaho game wardens, did this come up?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. It's really hard not to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, literally when they said, yeah, I'm glad to have you along, like to have another badge gun, they, you know, went right into talking about because this happened.
Yeah.
And yeah, that may have been that may have actually been the way that I, you know, first heard about it or heard about it at all, was on those ride-alongs.
Well, let's talk about the story. It takes place in the high desert around what was known as Paradise Valley in the vast area of the Idaho, Nevada, Oregon wilderness area, right in that tri-state area. But the incident technically happened in the Owyhee country, which O-W-Y-H-E-E is how that's spelled. And it was at a place called Bull Camp along the South Fork of the Owyhee River, which was 3 miles from the Nevada border in Owyhee County, Idaho, technically. And Owyhee County has a total of like 7,600 square miles, and it's the second largest county in Idaho by area, not by population. Nearly all of that area is high intermountain desert with plentiful sagebrush and basalt canyons. And the Owyhee Mountains in the west dominate the landscape, with Hayden Peak reaching 8,400 feet above sea level. And the lowest elevation is at the county's northwest corner, where the Snake River is just above 2,000 feet at the Oregon border. So on the evening of January 4th in 1981, a man named Ed Carlin, who was a trapper and a private landowner, telephoned the Idaho Game and Fish and got Officer Bill Pogue, P-O-G-U-E, to report finding illegal traps in the vicinity of the 45 Ranch in Owyhee County near the Idaho-Nevada border. Officer Pogue indicated he would be out there in a day or two to check the traps. When Carlin responded that a day or two would be too late, Pogue stated, okay, he's going to leave immediately, and he got his fellow officer, Conley Elms, to accompany him. And then the two men left Boise at about midnight that same evening. So they left in the middle of the night, which is risky in and of itself and very dedicated. And they arrived at the 45 Ranch early the next morning. So they had breakfast at the Carlin residence. And Pogue asked if there were any other trappers in the area. So a lot of these people know who's trapping and where they're trapping. And Carlin stated that in addition to some Oregon trappers, there was a trapper named Claude Dallas, who was camped at nearby Bull Camp. Don Carlin, Ed Carlin's son, further stated that on a recent visit to Dallas's camp, he had observed several deer carcasses and two bobcat hides, which were not in season, and it was illegal at that time to possess and to hunt those. So after breakfast, Don Carlin accompanied the officers to the site of the illegal traps. So Carlin left them there, and the officers proceeded to locate and issue a citation to the owner of the traps. Shortly thereafter, Don Carlin encountered the officers on the road back to the ranch. So the subject of Claude Dallas was again mentioned, and Carlin gave the officers directions to Dallas's camp, and Ed advised the officers about Dallas. Carlin warned them to be careful and told them he did not trust Dallas.
Yeah, I think that he also told them that Claude Dallas was armed, that he had seen that he was actually wearing a pistol of some sort on his side, and that he seemed dangerous.
Yeah. So,
you know, the officers had a sense that they were, you know, walking into a situation where the person might be armed and dangerous.
Right. Yeah. Well, Dallas's camp at Bull Camp is located in a remote basin on the banks of the South Fork of the Owyhee River, approximately 13 miles east of the Oregon border and 3 miles north of the Nevada border in Owyhee County. So a dirt road extends to the rim of the basin above the camp, but the camp itself is only accessible by following a foot trail, approximately 3/4 of a mile down the rim into the basin. Claude Dallas had established a trapping camp in Bull Camp in early December of 1980.
I think one of the things on his camp is that he had set up with his friends or anyone who would be coming to the camp a procedure where they would fire off 2 gunshots.
Oh.
Let him know that they were coming in. So nobody should be approaching his camp that he wasn't aware was coming, you know, was on their way in.
Yeah, that would stress me out if I was hearing a couple of gunshots, and I guess you'd have to trust that they're coming from your buddies. I don't know. That would stress me out.
Yeah, it lends to his, kind of stability of mind.
Well, Dallas's trapper's camp was where he poached and illegally trapped animals. And in fact, he was well known as being a very unethical and sloppy trapper and always poaching animals. And he acted as someone who didn't believe laws applied to him.
Yeah, I think that there's that mentality was certain areas, and it's kind of a subculture of people. That's, you know, under the culture of the hunters and outdoorsmen and sportsmen are the poachers, and they kind of run together, and
yeah,
it runs in families, and they raise their kids this way, and they teach each other how to basically do their poaching in ways that they're less likely to get caught, and how to cover up their tracks and hide their evidence and in those things. So in a lot of ways they have a lot of training, maybe as much training as the officers who are investigating them.
Well, right. Yeah. I don't doubt that. Well, besides being known for an unethical trapper, he also had a reputation for extreme cruelty to animals, including his own stock, cattle, his dog. And I won't go into some of those details, which some were actually pretty brutal.
Yes. One source that I saw said that he would actually shoot wild horses and may or may not have used them for food as well, but he would leave the carcasses out so when the coyotes came in, he could trap the coyotes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think that's legal.
I don't think that's legal. It's, no.
And several different, right. Several different yeah. laws.
Right. No matter who you ask. Well, it was reported at that time that he had illegal bobcat hides and a poached deer at his camp. Some locals were starting to complain about Claude Dallas because he had been poaching and trapping on their private ranches, and they didn't much appreciate that. And Dallas was very well known to the Idaho Fish and Game officers, but they just never seemed to catch him when they had had tips about him before. So on the morning of January 5th, 1981, at the same time the officers were investigating the trapping violation nearby, Jim Stevens, who was a friend of Dallas's, arrived at Bull Camp, and he was bringing supplies to Dallas's camp. And I wonder if he did the 2-shot thing before he got to his camp.
I think that he must have. I think there's not a lot known about Jim Stevens or who he was or why he was associating with Claude Dallas.
Yeah.
I guess it'd be presuming that he noticed or knew about all the different stuff that Claude was up to and still associated with him.
Hey, if I come to your house next time, if I come to your house next time, can I just fire 2 shots and you'll know who it is? And that way I won't have to come to the door.
Well, if if there's two shots fired in my house, that might not be a good idea. But
see, exactly.
Now that you've mentioned it, though, at least I'll know it's you.
Okay. All right. Well, you
know,
maybe I can.
Now that you let me know that might happen, I'll at least.
Right.
I'll at least take a look before I return any fire.
So up at that dirt road on the rim, Dallas encountered the fish and game officers Polk and Elms. And they then walked down the trail to Dallas's camp. And at some point during the contact, the officers disarmed Dallas of a .22 pistol, which he was carrying in a shoulder holster. However, he was also, Dallas was, armed with a .357 Magnum revolver located in a hip holster, and that weapon was not removed. And it sounds like he always carried the .357 concealed, so they might have thought the .22 was the only weapon he had on his person. And then the officers also checked Stevens' pistol and removed the bullets before returning it to him.
Yeah, and that's a real easy thing to, you know, to understand, that when someone hands over their gun that you asked them or told them to, that you're going to think that you're covered.
Right.
That's that they don't have multiple weapons. But a lot of people who do carry weapons carry multiple weapons and different kinds of weapons. So, and, you know, just the fact that they had the suspicion that he was armed and that he was possibly dangerous, in order for them to do their investigation, they have every, you know, legal authority to check a person and to take control of weapons during the mm-hmm. time that they're there. You know, they're not, in a way, they're affecting that person's right to, you know, their Second Amendment to bear arms, and their Fourth Amendment to be secure in their property and those things. But it's considered a reasonable seizure of a person for officers to be able to safely and effectively conduct their investigation.
Right.
Otherwise, it's asking an awful lot. The government, society doesn't ask law enforcement to knowingly put their lives at risk to try and figure out a poaching case or any kind of case to do their
right.
do their jobs. They can assess and mitigate the risk that they're in by doing things like that. And it sounds like in this case they're really just holding on to the guns where they're there, and they actually unloaded one and handed one back.
Right.
It's going above and beyond, the respect for their rights and for doing their job. So
right.
it seems like everything they were doing at that point was professional and above board.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, they're not violating any Second Amendment rights. They are not confiscating anybody's weapons. They're just making the scene safe. And if there are no serious crimes, then those weapons are going to almost always be returned. Well, apparently Officer Elms went into Dallas's tent where there were poached bobcats. And according to Jim Stevens later, there was a poached deer in plain view.
So when they had the suspicion that there was evidence in his tent, I have to kind of look into the officers' minds. And I think what they were experiencing was that ordinarily, if you're going into someone's residence or what they call a domicile, a place where mm-hmm. somebody lives,
yeah,
you need a warrant to go and do that and search and seize property. But there is a thing called exigent circumstances, which mm-hmm. is an exception to the warrant requirement. And basically, exigent circumstances just means that there's circumstances where you have some reason why you're not going to be able to collect this evidence if you do what you're going to have to do to get the warrant.
Yeah.
And thinking back to, like 1980, as you described, middle of nowhere, I can't imagine they had any kind of communication to coordinate anything to
right.
Get the warrant. And as soon as they turned their backs, that camp was going to be packed up and the evidence and the person were going to be gone.
Right.
So I would think that they had the exigency that, okay, we need to collect this evidence right now. And that it would be the warrant requirement issue and all that would be, cleared through the court procedures and all that later. So I think they were above board on that as well.
Yeah. While Officer Elms was in the tent, Claude Dallas just shot Officer Polk with his previously concealed .357. And when Officer Elms came out of the tent, Dallas shot him too.
Yeah, and I think that Officer Elms came out with a stack of, he was basically carrying a stack of first, whether they were, you know, I think they were Bobcats and, you know, other things that were illegal for him to have.
Right.
I don't think there was anything in season at this time that he was in possession of this illegally taken game. So it was basically, you know, Claude Dallas is saying, you know, he's caught red-handed.
Exactly.
At that point. So, you know, that was a triggering event. No pun, you know, not intending a pun there, but it definitely was at the point where he either had to do something or he was, you know, going to jail or getting some citations or whatever. They were going to take some action.
And when all this, it sounded like it happened very, very quickly. So when Elms is coming out, he did not have a quick opportunity for him to drop the hides, pull his weapon, take cover, and return fire at Claude Dallas. So it was basically an ambush of him coming out of the tent.
Right. So he was probably not presenting any kind of a threat
right.
to Claude Dallas at that time.
Yeah. So after the initial gunfire, Dallas used his .22 caliber level action rifle to shoot both officers execution style, once each in the head. Now that Dallas has murdered two law enforcement officers, he involved his friend Jim Stevens in getting rid of the bodies. And they loaded the bodies up on mules, tried to pack them on their mules to get them up to Stevens' vehicle. And Officer Elms' body was too much for the mule, apparently, so they just dumped his body into the Owyhee River and then continued with Officer Polk's body by loading him finally into Stevens' vehicle, then driving to a friend's house several hours away where Dallas borrowed a vehicle and drove it to a location in the desert, placing Polk's body in a shallow grave. And now Dallas just has fled the scene of the killings, and he was only found after an 11-month manhunt.
Yeah, and that's a really long time for, you know, a person to be able to evade, but he knew a lot of hiding places. And it's a lot of country, and that, but I would say that when someone murders or even assaults a police officer, but certainly when they murder any kind of law enforcement officer, that becomes all hands on deck.
Yeah.
Every law enforcement officer in the country, around the world even, is coming after that person, and they're never going to stop looking for that person.
Yeah.
And I mean, how many, you know, criminals are still being pursued 11 months later?
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly any homicide is taken very seriously, and there's going to be officers assigned to that case who are going to be relentless in coming, finding out where that person is and bringing them in.
Right.
But when it's a law enforcement officer, it's everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've actually gave that answer to a person once in the backcountry. Me and another ranger were contacting them, and we were outnumbered like, you know, 10 to 2.
Yeah.
And it was kind of shady who, you know, who these people, you know, might be, what they might be up to. And one of them asked us, you know, aren't you guys ever worried that you could be so easily killed out here? Which is just not a question that you ask, you know?
Right. And, exactly. That's put to,
and what came to, what came to mind at the time for me, I was probably pretty rookie-ish. but I said, well, the thing that gives me comfort is that anyone ever did anything to me, every law enforcement officer in the country would hunt them down and, you know, find them until they were either in prison or dead.
Yeah.
So that gives me comfort, you know, even though I might not be able to do anything about it. And that was a, you know, it's a pretty good conversation, you know, changer.
Yeah.
And
was there awkward silence after that? Ooh, or
yeah, there was kind of like that look like, are you threatening me?
Yeah. 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 Like, kind of.
Well, I'm not, but are you threatening me? Yeah. But yeah, I think we all left in, you know, as friends.
Oh, okay. I'm using, I'm pretending you're got air quotes going around the word friends there, but
yeah.
Well, Jim Stevens, pretty much immediately after that incident, reported the slaying and his role in the disposing of the bodies to law enforcement. And he claims that he didn't see the initial shooting of each officer, but he did witness Dallas shooting them both in the head. And the body of Conley Elms Jr., 34 years old, was sighted at noon that day from an Idaho Army National Guard helicopter, and he was lodged against a rock in the South Fork of the Owyhee River. But Jim did not have any knowledge of the whereabouts of Polk's remains. Claude Dallas was born in Winchester, Virginia, and his father was a dairy farmer. And when he was young, his family moved from the Shenandoah Valley to Michigan And Claude Dallas spent most of his childhood there, later moving to rural Ohio, where he learned to trap and hunt. And as a boy, Dallas read lots of books about the Old West and wanted to live like the 19th century characters in the books that he read.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I don't know exactly which books he read, but I've read a few Western books, know a little bit about Western history, and I've seen a lot of Western movies. And I would think an impressionable person, especially at that young age, when you look at some of these stories, a lot of them, the outlaws are kind of the good guys. You know, they're kind of written to have you sympathize with, you know, the Jesse James,
right?
The, you know, Butch Cassidy, Billy the Sundance Kid. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're kind of the hero of this the story. You know, the sheriff is kind of this. You know, sometimes the sheriff is the bad guy, and the sheriff is out to, you know, shoot first and ask questions later, kind of thing. And a lot of them kind of culminate with that this shootout where whoever can draw the fastest and kill the other person first is the one who has justice on their side, or they're the one who's in the right. So that's not really a safe mentality for a person to be out there in the woods with when you're the law enforcement that has to go and approach them. If he's kind of been living this way his whole, you know, life and not really going out of it.
Yeah. Well, after he graduated high school, he headed out west and he was hitchhiking most of the way across the U.S. and finally landed in Oregon, where he got a job as a ranch hand and a trapper. Apparently, he didn't maintain much contact with his family back east. He claimed to be unaware of these draft notices that got mailed to his parents, ordering him to report for induction into the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. When Dallas failed to report for his induction into the military on September 17th, 1970, the government issued a warrant for his arrest, so he would have been 20 years old at that time. And he was eventually tracked down more than 3 years later by the FBI. So Dallas was arrested for draft dodging on October 15th, 1973. Despite that, by that time, it had already been announced by the Secretary of Defense earlier that no further draft orders would be issued, so ending the draft. He was transported back to Ohio and released into custody of his parents. And at trial, the draft board couldn't prove that Dallas, who was working as a cowboy on a remote ranch, ever knew of the induction letters, and the charges were dropped. But the experience led Dallas to deeply distrust the government.
I can almost understand that in a way. I mean, if you look at it in the times, when you think about, you know, you're being drafted into the Vietnam War and it's a crime not to, it basically did make criminals out of a lot of people because they didn't want to participate in that war. And then, you know, eventually being arrested for not doing that there. I mean, a lot of people were anti-government at that time because that, you know, only for that reason. Well, the government is trying to make me go put my life on the line for something I don't want to do, and they're going to throw me in jail if I don't do it. That was seen as very oppressive, and there are plenty of people protesting against that and doing things like, you know, going to Canada and hiding out and that, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, that may have been part of what it added to his whole outlaw mentality and his anti-government, anti-authority mentality. And then, you know, going to how he was arrested, I also read in one of the sources that he had been profiled in some kind of a cowboy magazine or a ranching magazine or something that had a photo and a picture of him. And that's actually how the FBI became aware of what ranch he was at.
Interesting.
And, you know, what he was doing. And they went out and I think he had some kind of reputation for being dangerous, or maybe they were just being extra careful, but they came into the bunkhouse in the middle of the night and just woke him up.
Interesting.
Under arrest and carted him off to jail.
Huh.
So some of the other criminal activity, so just the draft dodging crime wasn't the only thing that made him a criminal. So with trapping and hunting, fishing, all that, there are a lot of rules.
Right.
Because there's a lot of ways that you can, a lot of things in nature that you can take advantage of that you can easily take game.
Yeah.
So if you were having to survive or, you know, there's a lot of things that, that, you know, that you could do. But at that time, when he was in going into the trapping business, he basically bailed on the ranching after he went through the arrest with the FBI on the draft dodging thing.
Yeah.
He decided that he, one thing that he told his friends and people that he knew, I guess, is that he was never going to get arrested or go to jail again.
Mm.
And he just went a step further of his detachment from society and went out to be this mountain man. And trapping and selling furs was actually lucrative enough around that time. I don't know if it is now or not, but he could make enough money to keep that lifestyle going.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that the people who knew what he was up to did not see him as an ethical person, and that mm-hmm. he was not following the regulations of, in, you know, there's seasons, there's types of traps you can use, there's certain ways to set your traps, there's certain bait that you can use. And basically yeah. he was just violating all of that as
right.
it just didn't matter. And, you know, I think there's a mentality in that poaching subculture where it's almost better in their mind to do the opposite of the law. Like breaking the law is actually kind of their law.
Like a,
it's, it, they have like a badge of honor. Respect.
Yeah, like a badge of honor or something.
Yeah, like the, a certain amount of respect to who can be the most criminal.
Yeah.
And who can get away with the most things right. that you're not supposed to do yeah. and get paid. So it's not unlike any other criminal enterprise where there's
right.
networks of people involved. They know what the others are doing. They know what they're doing. And it, the competitiveness of it is, there's an unfairness. There's an unfair advantage to the poacher versus the ethical and legal trapper or hunter who is obeying the law and is pretty restricted on what they can do to get game. And that, but just the competitiveness of everyone who's out there leads to that cheating, you know,
yeah.
cheating the rules and cutting the corners so that you can get the, you know, the game that you want, which is very harmful to the populations of animals.
Exactly.
The, you know, the, really the whole conservation officer and, you know, the various Department of Natural Resources, they're concerned with maintaining populations. They're not out there hugging bunnies and
right.
you know, hugging trees and things like that as the individual animal. They're trying to do what's best for, you know, society and nature
exactly.
and their, in exactly. their environment that they're in.
Yeah.
By maintaining these populations. So a poacher can come into an area and decimate a population because
yeah.
they're not within those rules that are set up to
yeah.
maintain those populations.
It was said at that time that Dallas became basically public enemy number one as far as the desire to catch him in the act of trapping and poaching. This is prior to the shooting. He was very well known. And Officer Polk was also known by fellow wardens as quite good at his job, especially when it comes to catching poachers and people doing that illegal activity that you're just talking about. He was considered fair across the board, and it was said that he just didn't provide favoritism to anyone. And so he wasn't out there giving people verbal warnings for poaching an elk. So some residents in the area considered Polk to be what they called badge heavy. And even some of his fellow wardens felt that way too. But I mean, we know officers that are what we would call, you know, by the book, I guess is a nice way of saying it, or maybe
yeah.
a little overzealous. I mean, those people exist. And as long as he was fair, which he was referred to being an officer who was fair, I'm just guessing that people, you know, who got cited didn't think they should have gotten cited, and they thought they should have gotten a warning. And that might be why mm-hmm. they called him badge heavy. I don't know.
Yeah, I think everyone likes law enforcement when they're dealing with somebody else.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point.
Sure. Everyone likes to see the police cars across the street.
Yeah.
At the neighbor's house.
Right. Right. But not at your own house, exactly.
No, then you're heavy-handed. Now you've gone too far.
Yeah. But you know what was disturbing? There were some folks around there that knew Dallas and knew of Dallas and knew of Polk and said that, you know, they even thought that maybe the officers, quote, had it coming, which there's never an excuse to murder someone, especially an officer of the law.
Yeah, and it's really hard to make a self-defense case
yeah.
based on, well, they were going to arrest me, so
right.
I had to kill them.
Finally, 15 months later, FBI SWAT, along with local agencies, actually locate Dallas in northern Nevada. And he was in an old camper, and they had him surrounded. And he bursts through the back window and jumps in his truck and leads the cop on a low speed chase. So squirrel trail, you know, I don't know what you're thinking of when you hear the words low speed chase, but I'm picturing OJ yeah. Simpson in the white Bronco going across the sagebrush on a low speed yeah. chase.
With 50 police cars.
Exactly.
Running out of gas. Right.
So Dallas shoots at the officers as they're pursuing him, and then they shoot and injure Dallas in the leg. And at that point, he surrenders and he's taken into custody, and he's charged with 2 counts of first degree murder, use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, resisting officers in the lawful performance of their duties, and destruction or concealment of evidence, which they dumped and buried bodies. They concealed or hid the guns. Did I get that right? What was some of the evidence yes. that they were concealing?
He burned all of their clothing, I believe.
Ah.
And then he disposed of the bodies. He said that he buried the guns somewhere, but he couldn't say where. He said he didn't remember where yeah. they were. So maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Well, trial started on September 15th, 1982, and then it lasted about 6 weeks and ended on October 24th. Dallas presented what you alluded to, a self-defense theory at trial, and that was only by his own testimony because there were no witnesses. Even Jim Stevens says he didn't see the initial shots. So basically, he testified that, hey, he did this in self-defense. And Jim Stevens did testify that Dallas quickly drew a .357 pistol that was, he said, strapped to his leg in trial. But I think other documentation said it was on his hip. He shot Polk twice, shot Elms twice, and then shot Polk twice more. He then goes into his tent, gets his .22 rifle, comes back out, and then shoots both Pogue and Elms in the back of their heads.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound a lot like self-defense by any means, to me. But I know a really good way that you can protect yourself with the police is you could put your hands up in the air and,
right.
Open your hands. And you're probably I would say 100 times out of 100, you're not going to get shot.
Yeah, you comply. And Dallas used the fact that some people said Pogue was badge heavy to show that he truly thought Pogue was going to kill him. And he had said that Officer Pogue had put his hand on his gun, and that's why Dallas shot him. Of course, there were no witnesses to testify that Pogue put his hand on his gun or even drew his gun. If you're dealing with a dangerous violator who was reported to them, they believed he was dangerous, and who's also carried a gun, it's quite possible that you as a law enforcement officer might have a reason that you have to control them at gunpoint or make it so you can actually react to their potential lethal aggression a little quicker. Like back to that where you said, right. who can draw first. You definitely don't want to be the underdog on that one for sure. And you just don't have the right to shoot a cop in self-defense who is trying to gain compliance or who's investigating you. And the defense did in trial also try to sully the character of Officer Pogue, because if you don't really have a defense for what you're doing, then why don't you just sully the character of the officers or attack the prosecution or something like that? But because that to me tells me you don't have a really good defense.
Right. And that shouldn't work.
No, it should not work.
That, it seems that, on a lot of these counts, just this whole story just tells me that if you're ever going to commit crimes, you want to be in 1980 in Southern Idaho.
Right. Western Idaho or whatever. But yes, Southern works too, I think. Well, they never did find the body of Officer Polk, but at least at trial, Dallas did show them where the body was buried. And finally, after 8 days of deliberation, the jury said they just were unable to reach a verdict, 4-4. So what they did instead was opt for manslaughter. And two jurors actually bought his story of self-defense. So the jury acquitted Dallas of first degree murder and second degree murder option, but deemed him guilty on two counts of manslaughter. And so the judge, who was not happy about the acquittal on the murder charges, because I think to any rational person, it was open and shut. But he sentenced Dallas to the maximum of 10 years for each murder and 10 years for using a firearm in the commission of a felony. And also my understanding was they acquitted him on resisting arrest. And I think they gave him some misdemeanor conviction on evidence, destruction of evidence.
I would have been looking for 12 months on the poaching stuff too, but that's
exactly
just me.
I mean, you know, on times like this, like you, I'm surprised prosecution didn't pile everything on. And sometimes when you do that, you know, maybe you reduce some of the charges so that you can maybe either get a plea deal or anything. But I didn't see anything alluding to the fact that there was ever a plea deal on the table. But he got 30 years total sentencing, and he did appeal, but his conviction was upheld. But that's not the end of this story. Nope.
Really?
No, because Claude Dallas escaped from the Idaho State Penitentiary in 1986 and was on the run for almost a year. And there were a couple of rumors surrounding his escape. And one was that he somehow managed to cut a section of the fence surrounding the penitentiary and just walk out that way. And another rumor was that someone assisted him and he just walked right out the door. And that maybe later a prison guard cut the fence himself to throw the prison investigators off of what really happened. So his escape just, you know, made him more of a legend in that he was some nomadic trapper whose lifestyle conflicted with the government, and that some folk hero living off the grid, never to be caught. And well, Dallas was caught. Finally, he was captured. This is referred to as a little ironic for somebody who's supposedly a folk hero living off the land. He was captured outside a 7-Eleven store in Riverside, California. In March.
He was probably, I think at the 7-Eleven, he was getting some wild horse jerky off of the shelf there or something.
Probably, yeah.
I'm not sure, but they caught him anyway.
Yeah, and he was then placed in a higher security state prison in Kansas. And there was actually a trial for his prison escape, and he was acquitted. How is that a thing? Who's on the jury? Yeah, well, he just walked out or he cut the fence, but we're just going to say not guilty. How do you do that?
Well, I think maybe they just wanted to stay consistent with that. Basically he gets, gets away with everything or gets very light sentences for what he does. So, you know, we don't want to start hammering him now.
No.
I mean, it's really like he escaped from prison and then they were asked, do you think he's guilty of escaping from prison? And they said no. And what I read, my understanding was that the jury was somehow convinced that it was okay for him to have escaped from prison because he wasn't trying to escape so that he didn't have to serve his time. He was trying to escape because of the dangers of being in prison. Again, it was a self-defense thing. He was just trying to protect his safety and his life because being in prison isn't a safe place for a person to be. So I guess that means it's okay.
says everyone in prison.
Nobody wants to be there.
And what's to keep him from just walking out the door again? Because it wasn't a crime.
Hopefully they didn't lend him next time he went and asked for some bolt cutters because he had a project to work on.
Right.
They didn't hand him out.
Well, he did serve a total of 22 out of 30 years in prison, and his sentence got reduced by 8 years for good behavior. I didn't know escaping prison was considered good behavior, but I think
staying in is the behavior you're supposed to follow.
Right.
If nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, you would use up all of your good behavior points or something, I would think.
Yeah, I guess he made his bed every day after that, and it made it.
Oh, right. Well, I've tried to find where Claude Dallas might be today, and he's 73 or 74 years old. And many people said he went to Alaska to to live, and supposedly he was sighted in Grouse Creek, Utah, but I haven't seen anything that says for sure. And I imagine that once he got out, he probably went right back to living the same way, off the grid, and because it sounds to me like that's all he knows, or at the time, that's all he knew.
Right. So I guess the last thing I would have to say, I just want to go back to the seriousness of what actually happened to these two officers. Everybody wants to talk about Claude Dallas, and so his name is very well known. There's books about him. There's lots of documentaries, and you know, people know his name, but it's really, Bill Pogue and Conley Elms who are the central figures in this story. And they were just trying to do their job,
right?
Which I think was a very honorable profession that they're in. They got caught, off guard in a way because they were trying to be professional and fair to him. Is my impression of it. And they didn't expect to be killed that day. They went out in the middle of the night to go do their job because they were that dedicated to it. And also the lessons learned from the sacrifice of their lives. Every officer since then has, thought about things that could have been done different, improved on tactics, on communications, so many different things that we do. And, this happened in the 1980s. It was one of the first incidents that we heard about coming in our time. But there have been so many, just even in our agency, of people who we actually have known and have experienced and fallen victim and lost their lives in the line of duty. And we all have learned things, that we wish would have happened. If only this, had they known this, or had they done this, or had this piece of equipment, or whatever. Every one of those things has a person's name attached to it.
Yeah, it does.
And, we really owe them, a debt of gratitude. And, these two men are the heroes of this story. Yeah. People, have made this Claude Dallas out to be some kind of a Western outlaw, hero. And, to me, it's kind of like, whatever happened to him, I really don't care.
Yeah, exactly.
He should still be in prison, or maybe should not have made it out of some of these situations where he's having shootouts with law enforcement and that kind of thing. So, I just wanted to, pay respect to those two officers. And, that's where I would leave it, is that we never forget that, people have lost their lives in the line of duty given us the benefit of being able to train ourselves to not have this happen to us.
Exactly. I appreciate those words. Well, that's all we have for this story today. And thanks again, Ranger Dan, for coming on and discussing this case. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tara. That was great.
Well, stay safe in wild places, everyone, and watch out for the company you keep.